You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. This episode is sponsored by Nomad. Own less, live more. And by Heritage Business International. Check out their business tips at the second break. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 104 for February 15th, 2017. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about the drive-through masters and the differences between the US, UK, and Canadian MA programs. We have some heated discussions about the value of certain programs and choices. So, go retake your GREs because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Doug in Scotland.
Hey.
Steven in Calgary.
Hello.
Chris in Oregon.
Hi.
And Bill in Arizona.
Good morning.
All right, so at the end of the last episode, I'm not sure how much of this actually made it into the show, how much of this discussion, but we did start talking about pretty extensively the so-called drive-through masters phenomenon. And by that, I just mean like a UK masters where it's usually usually a one-year program, or there's a growing number of shorter programs, or at least more convenient programs for CRM archaeologists in the United States. I personally went through a one-year master's program. It was still 33 credits. I still did a thesis paper. It was all done a little different. You don't have enough time to do any teaching or anything like that, and you don't really have time unless you want to take the extra time. But it's not designed for this. You didn't really have time to do your own project. What I mean by that is they have a bunch of data sets there from decades ago that were just never written up. So that's what I did. I took one of their data sets from like the 70s, I think. And it was an excavation that was done under what's now a lake, a reservoir. And I analyzed all the pottery and lithics from that, did some further testing, and basically wrote up a thesis, which is basically in the format of a site report for Georgia, because this was at the University of Georgia at Athens. And I think it was a really good exercise. Like I said, it was 1 year. It was 15 credits per semester, with one of the semesters being 18 credits. So three semesters, spring, fall, summer. Now, that's really tough to do. You really have to be on your toes to get that kind of thing done, because there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to do with my project, you know, things like that. And there were five people in my cohort that started with me, and only two of us graduated that end of that July. So on July 31st, I think. So that shows you how difficult it was. One or maybe two of the others graduated the following semester at the end of December. And one of them graduated, I think, the following semester after that. So, but you can see how it can quickly get behind if you don't keep up with it. Now, one of the things we're going to talk about here is also the UK Masters, of which I don't have a lot of experience with. I know people that have done it, but I don't know a lot about it. Luckily, we have somebody on the show that knows a little bit about it, and that is Doug. Doug's lived over in Scotland for a while and has got his education over there. So, Doug, I think I'm going to throw it to you to keep this conversation going, and then we'll just pepper you with questions on the end. So what do you know about a UK Masters? Before we get into the whys and should use and things like that, what is entailed typically in a UK Masters?
Yeah. So well, it'd be good if also one of you guys jump in with, I mean, Chris has just shared his experience with his 1 year masters in the US, but I think there are some significant differences between how the programs are run. Mm-hmm. And so usually, and we're talking full-time here, a UK master's is 1 year. You have two options of, two options. One's a master's of philosophy, and one's like a MA, Master of Arts, or Master of Science. Usually, if you're actually doing a PhD, you pick up a master's of philosophy, which is less course-based and more about writing. So you write up a project, a sort of smaller dissertation, something like that. Mm-hmm. Most people, when they come over for an MA or MSc. There's very few people who do a master's of philosophy just by itself when it's not attached as like the first year of their PhD. Mm. And it's it's a pretty different system. So I only can go off of what I experienced in my undergraduate. So at the University of New Mexico, I took courses with master's students. So there would be like a 300, 400 level course on, let's say, the archaeology of Mesoamerica. But at the same time, there'd be PhD or master's students in that course who would also be taking that, but they'd be taking it as like a 500 or 600 level course. And they basically had to do extra. So if we had to write 10 pages as our sort of final paper, they had to do 20, 25. I'm just making up numbers right here. I don't remember the exact, but basically we all sat in at the same course when the professor was talking about it. They just had to do more work at the end. And I know there was some specific master's levels courses with only master's students, mm-hmm. but a lot of the courses were taught. So the upper level undergraduate students also were in there with the master's students. Whereas in the UK, and again, we're talking, 30 some programs, so it may not be the same in each of them. In the UK, you get an individual experience. So you're never combined with undergraduate students at all, unless there's, maybe you're doing a field school or something like that. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you don't have any interaction with any other undergraduate students. So it's very different. The contact hours are also probably different than what you would typically see in the US. So in the US, when we're talking about credit hours of like 16 credit hours, meaning that you're physically in class for like 16 hours. Mm-hmm. Typically in the UK, if you're an undergraduate, you maybe have 10 hours. So there's a lot less contact time. But essentially it runs similar to what you described, Chris, in that you do a fall semester, a spring semester, and then you have a summer semester of which you do your sort of write-up on your master's dissertation. You pick a topic, you get some sort of faculty advisor, and you write up what is a dissertation.
Let me interrupt real quick. That dissertation, where does the data for that come from? Because again, it still sounds like you don't have time to really do a lot of, field work during the course of that schoolwork.
It depends on who the student is. Mm-hmm. So I went out and did field work, but I was more the exception for my cohort that I went through with. Lots of them, it's mainly just a really, really long desk-based sort of paper. Mm-hmm. But other people, they would go, they'd start an excavation maybe in the spring or the summer and then use that part of that. Or as what typically happens in a lot of cases, and this is US, UK, is they're handed a project by their advisor. Mm-hmm. So someone will say, oh, I have, 500 pottery shards that need to be written up into some sort of piece of work. And they'll do the analysis for that. Or, mm-hmm. We need someone to look at this and, maybe bones, something along those lines. It also depends on what sort of master's you're doing. So like the osteology students, there's pretty much involved looking at collections and doing analysis of a lot of different materials. So they didn't necessarily need to go out and dig it, but typically with most osteology sort of work, you're looking at it back in the lab instead of looking at it out in the field. So it really varies on what your topic was and what you were interested in.
Okay.
And then there's also some other slight differences. The length of the of your semesters are more compressed. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., again, I'm going to go with typically what I experienced from undergraduate. We were looking at 16 weeks was your typical semester. 16, 18 weeks. That's pretty much what you guys experienced, right? Yeah, I think that's pretty typical. In the UK, you're looking at maybe 12 weeks. So you're looking at fewer contact hours and not as many weeks to take your courses. Mm-hmm. But there's a higher expectation of you doing more independent work on your own. Whether you do that or not, it comes more down to the individual.
Right.
And so that is sort of your typical, the big differences I know between the UK and US sort of based master's is it's a sort of three semester compressed master's.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I got some other I think major differences that I want to talk about, especially for CRM archaeologists. But real quick here, you've got Canada down in the show notes. And honestly, I had never even considered Canada for education for a CRM program. Now I know there's some pretty great programs up in Canada, like in Montreal and things like that, for some other programs. But you know, as far as CRM archaeologists getting a master's up there, I never really considered Canada. It's always US or UK. So does anybody know anything about any master's level programs that maybe CRM archaeologists have taken that you know of? Did anybody hear anything like that?
Usually it gets called like heritage resource management up here. Of those types of programs, there are two that I think I've heard about. One is actually with Simon Fraser University, and it's very much oriented towards the business setting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's one at University of Victoria, I think it is, that I really don't know any of the details about it. I've just heard that they have a master's in heritage management, so I'm not exactly certain what that entails. Most of the archaeologists that I know who have MAs have gotten MAs in a more traditional university setting.
And you know, the Canadian ones, are they more the US style for length of time and format, or is it more the UK style? Do you know?
I think it's more the US style.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. And part of that is I really don't. I mean, it's been 20 years since I was in grad school, so I really don't remember what my schedule was like as far as how many weeks or anything like that goes.
Right.
The Canada tends to be more closer to the US style, whereas other countries such as like South Africa or, you know, more colonial ones like Australia tend to be closer to the UK, but not quite. It's actually across the world, it's really big variation. So like across European countries, it's usually a year to 2 years, but huge differences. Like some countries have, you know, undergraduate courses that take 5 years and then a 1 year master's. Some year have like 3 years for an undergraduate and then like 2 years for a master's. It's pretty, you know, there's a big diversity in what courses are across countries. Though in Europe, basically most countries, I think it's 50 some now, are part of the Bologna Convention. Okay. Which basically means that your degree, if you take a degree in any of these countries that are part of this treaty, it translates across. So a master's in the UK is equivalent to a master's in Germany, even if the master's in Germany takes 2 or 3 years. It's just they've sort of made all the systems match up in different ways. So you're getting similar credits that transfer across, but you may be, you know, spending more time in a class or less. You may be doing more field work or less. You may be mm-hmm. taking more couple of years or 1 year. It's quite diverse, but they're all supposed to be able to be equivalent.
Right. I think one of the things some people have to consider when they're trying to figure out, you know, first off, whether they need a master's and then where they're going to take their master's is really what you want to get out of it as well. Because there are a growing number of programs here in the United States, and we've interviewed people from several of them, that are specifically dealing with cultural resource management. Sonoma State is the one famous example. The one I went to is closed now. That might tell you something about their commitment to it. But there's also Adams State, which is an online master's. Now, that's not a short one either. That's like Sonoma State. That's a full length, you know, several years. But it's done mostly remotely, the Adams State one is. And we did interview Tim Goddard from Adams State a couple years ago, actually, on this program, when they were just starting their program out. So but it would be, you know, you got to think, do you want to learn about something that's really specific and you just want a master's degree in some sort of topic that you're interested in, and maybe the school you want to go to is in the UK or Canada, then that's fine. But if you want to learn about cultural resources management in the United States, you're going to have to get a master's degree here in that type of program if that's your interest. So it's a really big thing. If you just want to check that block, then... if you just want to check that block and get your master's and then get back out into the workforce and hope that works for you, then you might want to just get the shortest thing you possibly can and get back into it. So, Bill, you haven't had a chance to speak yet. What do you have some comments on that?
Yeah, man, as a lifelong student, of course I have comments about that. if you do want to learn about cultural resources and you're going for your master's, you will have to be judicious about choosing the programs that actually address that and make efforts to emphasize that. So not all master's programs are the same. And if you wanted to learn about cultural resource management, you're going to have to do a little bit of homework and see who on that staff or who in the faculty actually does cultural resource management. How many classes do they have that are devoted to that? How many people on the staff have actually ever done cultural resources? You're going to need to, in your process of looking for a program, it's most likely you're going to interview at schools or at least talk to people who are at those universities. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that, if you do want to do cultural resources, that's the time that you start asking about cultural resources and who at that department knows anything about it. Because there is a shift going on where more schools are knowledgeable about cultural resources, but it's not, it hasn't expanded to the point where every program is all about cultural resources, or that you'll get enough education in your master's that will enable you to transfer that to a career in cultural resource management. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Steven, real quick before we go to break, you said I was mis-selling it. What do you mean by that?
I think Bill touched a lot on that, but I think that in general, I think I have a problem with taking a program that is specifically geared towards CRM. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because my background was not a CRM specific background.
Right.
I took a four field approach, standard academic archaeology, or anthropology course path. And I think that a lot of what we talk about, like as far as like what you ought to learn for CRM, you know, tend to be kind of side things, you know, business, the regulatory setting, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And even non, you know, quote unquote CRM programs, often, you know, you can, maybe not business, but definitely with the regulatory stuff, usually there's a course offered or you can take it as an independent study, stuff like that, what you need to learn. And I know we're heading towards the break, so this might want to carry this on break, but generally what you want to learn are things that'll make you better at your job, and that's not necessarily that's not necessarily the the nuts and bolts technical aspects of business. Whereas what you need to do is partly because of the way that the undergrad program is generally set up, is there are things that you need to continue to learn to be a better archaeologist at the MA level portions of the job that are not taught in generally for undergrads, and are not usually, it's not the sort of thing that you just pick up in the job unless someone's actually taking you aside and doing some sort of internship or training. And as we all know, in the private commercial sector, not a lot of firms are going to spend that kind of money on you.
All right. Well, let's pick this up on the other side of the break, because I definitely have some comments on that, and I know the other guys do too. So we'll be back in just a second, but be sure to not skip this ad from Nomad coming up, because there's a really great 20% off coupon mentioned at the end of it, and they've got some great stuff at affordable prices. So we'll be back in just a second. Nomad is an outdoor tech company focused on one thing: owning fewer things, being resourceful, and working together. I've got a couple Nomad products: the Modern Build leather strap for Apple Watch and the Carabiner for iPhone. The Apple Watch strap is well built and very affordable when compared to similar products online. I've had the Carabiner for over a year now and I love it. Holds my keys and turns into an emergency lightning cable for my iPhone or iPad whenever I need it. Check out Nomad's other products at www.hellonomad.com and use the discount code CRM for 20% off your order. That's www.hellonomad.com. Fulfill your minimalist mission. Own less and live more with Nomad. All right, we're back. And I have a comment on Steven, what you were saying last time, because I feel like, as we've talked about before, I feel like our entire education system is broken, because both you and Bill are talking about, even in the chat on the background here, that the four-field approach in your master's degree is a good way to go. But I personally don't think that for CRM archaeology, because and also for CRM arcs, if you're going to a CRM program and studying CRM things, I don't understand really how that's different than saying, I want to study underwater basket weaving in Lake Tahoe, and then just focusing on that for your master's, right? I don't see that really as any different. But I feel like our education system should ideally go like this. You're exposed to the four-field approach during your undergrad degree, right? This is more of a generalized sort of thing. Your undergraduate degree is, you know, you're learning all the things and getting exposed to all the things, ideally. I know that's not how it works in a lot of cases, but ideally, that's what it would be. And then you get to your master's, and I mean, really, it should be more like a technical school where you learn specifics about what you want to do. If it's too broad, then what the hell's the point of it? You know what I mean? I mean, you can learn some broad general theory type ideas, but the general thrust of the entire program should be more focused on what you're going to be a master of. Let's get back and own that term. You know, you're a master of science. You're a master of, well, art. That's to be debated. But, you know, let's get back to that. I mean, how can you generalize a 2 to 3 year long degree or even a 1 year degree and become an expert in it? You know what I mean? So I feel like the master's program should be more like a technical school where you do learn those very specific things, and then you find the school that will teach you those very specific things. Your field skills should come from field school, maybe some, you know, methods class, some field methods classes, but it's difficult. It's difficult because we don't have the programs that are really covering all this. So I
think I'm gonna piss off both sides of this conversation. In that I agree that there shouldn't be a four field focus, but I disagree with you, Chris. And I think my problem is I think the four field is too narrow, and that if you're going in. I support the four field, and then it exposes you to other aspects, other ways of thinking. I mean, you know, you could be doing linguistics or biological anthropology, stuff like that. And those are skills you can pick up and knowledge that you'll pick up that will be valuable, or maybe not, but it's something different that you can apply to your work. But where I disagree is I kind of think that too many programs are focused on, oh, you should do the four fields. And like, if you're interested in GIS and spatial skills or geology, you should be looking at, you know, a department like geology or geography. And I think that having just too narrow a focus probably hampers you in your career. You need to have several, you know, different interests and a much broader knowledge. And I know you're talking about master's specializing and stuff like that, but I really do think that if you're going into a master's, it shouldn't just be archaeology, because archaeology encompasses so much. We touch on so many different fields, whether it be biology, environmental. I mean, there's so many different things. And unfortunately, you go into a master's and you learn just about archaeology. Okay, so maybe you take some geomorphology classes to learn about soils, but you're actually not usually, and this, okay, I'll backtrack that. Not many departments send you out to, you know, your geology department to learn that stuff as well, when you should have sort of a double master's, as it were. So that's where I'm going to say is I think you guys are all wrong. And it shouldn't just be the four fields, but it shouldn't be just so, so narrow.
Bill, I think you're forcing yourself next into the conversation.
Yeah, because I'm ready to go Tom King without the cursing. I'll channel the spirit of Tom King. I guess the whole question is, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to read some kind of law and look at paragraph 34, you know, 36 CFR and say, ooh, well, if it's three of the four criteria of significance as created by someone way over in Washington, D.C., therefore, I'm going to make sure this paragraph addresses it in a very static way. Then I'll hand it to my client. He's going to pat me on my head. The dozers will roll and justice will have been done, right? So if our whole goal is to sit there and get boxes checked so DAPL can go down a lot smoother. Yeah, then you should just concentrate straight up. It should be like a second MBA. Don't learn about archaeology or anthropology or anything. Just learn about contracts, exactly how to get this stuff done, how to plan and make it super regimented so that every single project will be executed seamlessly. And in the end, you know, you'll get what you get. But I'm pretty sure Tom would say that we're not just supposed to be getting boxes checked. We're supposed to be conserving properties for communities. And if you read the law, it actually was designed for communities to be able to protect historic properties. And there's supposed to be a consultation aspect. There's supposed to be a communication aspect. There's a certain level of humanism that goes along with anthropology that if you don't use CRM, which is our number one platform for doing this kind of stuff. If you don't use CRM to get into some of this deeper heritage conservation work, then really you're not doing what the spirit of the law was created for. And I think the biggest problem that CRM has right now is for so long we have just had our head down looking at every single line. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had my reports edited so that they have a very, very static, straightforward, statement-oriented type of speech that addresses one tiny paragraph of one law, right? In the meantime, I could have been doing something in someone's community. They have no idea that a new Walmart's coming. They have no idea that there's a Native American village right there. I dig all the stuff up. I take a lot of pictures, analyze it all, hand it over, and the next thing you know, it's all gone. But we've preserved it according to CRM. No one in the community knows that thing is there. No one whose ancestors helped create that has any idea that their entire thing has been destroyed. I mean, if we don't move outside of the box, and if we don't use a more holistic approach, and even though I don't like linguistics, even if we don't use all our knowledge of anthropology, we're not really serving the communities that we're working in.
All right, so let me defend myself just for a little bit here, because if you guys noticed, I didn't say don't study those things. I just said you should get them in your undergrad. If every single archaeologist or anthropologist on the planet, or let's just say United States, just to distill it down to us, if you're not learning those cultural sensitivities in your undergrad, then they failed. They absolutely failed. I think if you need to learn that stuff just to get a master's degree in your master's program, then you learned it way too freaking late. Because you know what? Those people on DAPL, there was one person out there with a master's, maybe two. The rest of them were field technicians, which, according to you guys, have no cultural sensitivity because they didn't get it in a master's program. I totally don't buy that at all. You should get that in your undergrad, the four-field approach in your undergrad, and your master's degree should actually teach you about the laws, should teach you how to check the right boxes, should teach you how to interpret the regulations. That's what that's for. You learn how to be an anthropologist in your undergrad. You learn how to be a professional in your master's program, okay? I don't think I could even bend on that. I mean, that just seems logical to me. And then if you want to go the next step up and learn higher level theory, then you go for your PhD like you're doing, Bill. I think that's when you get back into that.
Lots to unpack now. I think to go back, I'm heavily in agreement with Bill for most things, but you do make good points. I think that to go back to the idea that you mentioned a while ago, an hour or so ago.
Hour or so.
Yeah, that you know, masters should be more technical. I have a strong disagreement with that. And I think that, you know, perhaps you misspoke. Mm-hmm. Because that's not exactly what you're talking about in your defense from Bill. That, you know, you're talking about, like, you know, you need to understand the regulatory environment and stuff like that. I think that I have a major problem with the idea that, you know, a degree, particularly a master's degree, should be technical, in that you are taught specific processes of doing things. Mm-hmm. That, you know, on a broader level, you know, education is generally broadened that. And this is beyond archaeology. This is a major debate in higher education, period. Like, do you want technical skills where you're teaching people how to do specific things so they can go out and get those jobs that do specific things? Or do you want a broader level of education, which are more humanistic and, well, maybe not even more humanistic, but give you a broader breadth. Yeah, that sounds great. greater breadth of education, so that you're given the technical skills that you're given to technical are more oriented towards your ability to develop the techniques needed for any given project.
Right.
That, and you kind of hit on that when you're talking about, you know, the learning the regulations and stuff like that, but it goes a little bit further than that. And to go with something Doug was talking about where, you know, you ought to be taking a geology course. Like, no. What if I'm a historic archaeologist who works in urban environments? Geology, you know, past laws of superposition, geology is not a factor. I'm not dealing with stone tools. I'm dealing with, you know, I'm dealing with like architecture, building, urban planning, stuff like that. These are CRM topics that aren't necessarily addressed. And mm-hmm. if you limit yourself to specific, you know, here's how you dig a site, here's how you set up a survey, without dealing with, you know, the broader methodological, you know, theory, the middle range theory, you know, not necessarily the high theory that you're talking about for like your doctorate, but right. the middle range theory that drives how we do things, then you are, I'd hate to say it, but you are definitely going to be weaker in some certain types of projects.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, ultimately what you should be getting at that master's level is, you know, increased depth on your particular areas of focus. And a lot of that's not even chosen for you, you know, because you end up doing ceramics, say, because your advisor wants you to do ceramics.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, that broader middle range theory that drives how you're going to do things.
Right.
And how, and you know, that comes down on a practical level. That comes down into how we, you know, everything from how we make bids to how we, you know, what our research designs are to, you know, all aspects of running a project within CRM archaeology and other aspects of CRM.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, that was probably not clear. Just to comment on what Chris was, or what Stephen was saying. Well, I was giving an example of like geology. I didn't mean it as in all archaeologists to do it. I was thinking more broad as in, if you go for a master's, you should have a really broad range of choice that's relevant to what you're interested in. So all those things you were mentioning, Stephen, I was thinking, yeah, that could be it. But if you want to be like a geomorphologist-based archaeologist, I was thinking if you're doing a master's, you should, you know, have that sort of a program for that sort of range. So I wasn't saying that all, if you're doing a master's, you should be very broad and do that. I was thinking you should take two or three skills, whatever they may be, that's relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree with both Doug and Steven on that. I think that there were a lot of good points shared from both of you. And, you know, Steven, I've heard you say before, and it's a comment that you said, I don't know, on an episode maybe a couple of years ago that has rung in my head for a long time, is that a degree does not equal a job. And, you know, Doug, your advice on reaching out and thinking outside of the box of the four-field approach is really good as well. And I think that both of those speak a lot to the problems at hand right now in archaeology as a field, you know. So we've got, you know, kind of some traditional limitations where, you know, we're being confined by market forces and political climates and whatnot. But there's also this problem of the job market that, you know, depending on your perspective, you could see it as, you know, dwindling opportunities. But if you don't view your degree as something that translates directly to a job, and if you don't view your experience as something that translates directly to what you learned in school, then you can think outside the box.
So this is actually sort of a comment on something you said earlier, Chris, and Chris Webster, and then actually just what everyone's been talking about is, I know, Chris, you're like, if you're going to do CRM in the States, you need to do a program over there. And this is how we got started on this whole drive-through masters from the UK and the sort of discrimination that faces that. And that a master's is not a career. And I actually personally know quite a few people that have gotten UK masters that have nothing to do with CRM, who have done quite well in CRM. So one of my fellow students at when I did my master's, didn't really have experience, came back 2010, height of the recession. Her master's was in Greek and Roman archaeology, nothing about CRM, has had an incredibly successful career, worked as, you know, shovel bummed it, did her time, worked up to project manager. She's now a PI, and that's, you know, a short, like, I actually think she did it in less than 5 years. She became a PI with a master's in Roman archaeology. And that is the whole, you know, you can get a diverse sort of education, you could still get the job you want without, I mean, the master's is there for certain reasons to check boxes, but you don't necessarily have to get a master's in exactly what you'd be doing as a career.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to head to break here soon, but I'll just take us into break with this. You know, I wasn't saying that you can't get a master's in whatever you want to get a master's in, wherever you want to get it, and not have a vibrant full career in cultural resources management. I also know a lot of people that got their, in fact, most of the people I know that got a master's did not get it in CRM because it's a fairly rare thing, quite frankly. So all the people I know that got master's in something else, they spent 3 to 5 years studying something very specific that they've literally never gone back to. Now, that exercise may have been good for them. It may have taught them some things about science, the scientific method, research, things like that. And I understand that that's a good exercise to do. However, if you're going to do that exercise anyway, why not do it in something that's relevant for the career path you've chosen rather than something you'll never research again? I'm not saying that's true for everybody. Maybe you manage to find something in CRM that helps you with your research interests and you can still focus on those. But more likely, you're going to be writing reports on pipelines all day. And it's not going to help you with whatever the hell you studied in your master's program. So I'm just throwing that out there. You can do a master's in whatever you want, study whatever you want, have a good time, but know that that may be the last time you ever see that. And Steven's asking, is that bad? No, that's not bad. It's a choice. And I'm just saying, make the choice based on what you want to do for your career. If you want to spend that time and that $30,000 to $60,000 having fun studying a side topic, then that's fine. But let's have the follow-ups and further comments in the last segment when we come back from break. But first, here's a business tip from Heritage Business International.
Hi, everyone. This is Christopher Doerr with Heritage Business International, and here is this week's Heritage Business Tip from the archive. This week, we look at an important point about managing your firm, your projects, and employees that may be under your supervision. Manage by metrics. While this may sound cold and impersonal within the culture of heritage organizations, it doesn't mean you have to abandon your good people skills. It simply means that you should have, monitor, and make decisions using key performance indices, also known as KPIs. These are indices that track the organization's performance results. As well, these KPIs should be made available to everyone in the organization. In that way, you are developing a team and keeping everyone's work focused on reaching your organizational goals. To receive our most up-to-date Heritage Business Tips, you can subscribe to our free weekly email at heritagebusiness.org. Until next time, this is Christopher Doerr.
All right, so when we left, I think Doug had a follow-up on the comment that I was making, and I'm sure the others do too because, no one ever really agrees with me on this. I'm here to be the other side, to be the questions people aren't asking. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I still disagree a bit with you there, Chris, in that back to Stevens, it's a degree, not a career, and you never know what direction your career is going to go in. Mm-hmm. I agree that you should definitely, I tell this to undergraduate students as well, if you're looking for a specific job, what's going to get you that job is not your degree, it's your experience in that. So if you want to do CRM, you really do need experience in digging and, report writing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I think we're assuming that archaeology is still going to be around and CRM is still going to be around in like 2 years with, Trump being here. You can't really plan for things like that. But also, I guess it does come back to one of the questions. I think we discussed this 2 weeks ago. Hiring degrees. What are your guys' opinion on hiring degrees? Chris, do you actually specifically look for people that have degrees in CRM when you do hiring for all your different projects?
Not necessarily, because it's difficult to do so. Like I said, most people don't have that. So when I have looked in the past, I'll take a look at the degree, but if somebody had, honestly, the degree to me, when I'm hiring at that level, unless they have no experience, using their degree. Like if they have no experience at the master's level position and they just got their degree, then I'll focus more on exactly what they did in that. But if they have experience post that doing CRM, then I'm going to actually focus on that, because the degree really was kind of a check in the block for CRM, you know, for what they're doing. I mean, I don't know. I hate to say it like that, but it really kind of was. If you've been, you know, as a master's level person in CRM archaeology, project management and stuff like that, you know, for 5-10 years, then that's what I'm going to focus on. Your degree from 5 or 10 years ago is hardly relevant in that case. So, but, you know, that being said, if I had two people that were sitting here that both had the same amount of experience, the same type of experience, then I would go back and look at that degree. And if one of them had their degree that was more focused on CRM, then I would probably choose them over the other person. But that's hard. That's a tough call to make. It's not black and white. You know, it's not binary for me in that case. You know, I would look at all the options. That being said, you know, and then we'll get to, I think, Steven's comment. It's, Doug, you mentioned, and you guys have all mentioned, you know, it's not a, you know, talking about the quality of the degree. I think, Doug, you've done a lot of hiring statistics and things like that, or you've done not hiring statistics, but statistics on the CRM industry. And there's a lot of people that get out of this field. There's a lot of people working at, you know, the Gap with a master's degree in archaeology, right? So maybe they did focus too much on one thing. I don't know. Maybe their degree was too general. Maybe they it's not applicable. Maybe they thought, wow, I studied this whole thing and now I'm writing up reports on pipelines and I hate my life, because they weren't exposed to what being a master's level professional in CRM was actually going to be, because they went to a traditional master's program. They didn't tell them anything about cultural resource management. They said, hey, look at this, you know, present at these conferences, write these journal articles, get all your funding, do all these things. And then they get out and they're writing reports on pipelines. Okay. And then they quit and then they go do something else. Now they're accountants. Now they're ski instructors. I don't know, but maybe that's part of the problem. You need to be exposed to what you're going to do.
Chris, that's exactly what I meant by adding some of the more diversity that attracts people to anthropology into these kind of just reports about pipelines, right? Mm-hmm. So you're just saying, well, they're writing the reports about pipelines, and this isn't what they really wanted to do. What they really wanted to do was study the spatial dynamics of so-and-so Greek settlements on whatever island, right?
Right.
Well, you know, that you may not be able to actually insert anything about Greece or stuff like that, but you can definitely add something about those spatial settlements and stuff. If your boss continues to edit out every time you add about, you know, the spatial distribution of the sites they did come across, or the fact that this pipeline went through this massive area with 4,300 sites, but it didn't actually hit any of them, like, what does that say about this landscape or what's going on? I mean, those are those kind of higher level things that if people had a chance to add some of that in, or if they actually took the opportunity to add it in, it would not only make the CRM report more than just compliance, but it also might give them a little bit of fulfillment about the job.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your comments, Chris, are along the lines of that what you do in your master's should always, you know, should be along the lines of it should be what you always do or what you want to do, and to continue that on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes that's exactly what happens, and it's not even by choice, is that, you know, when you start to specialize in stuff, experience has a certain amount of gravity. So what you've done, that kind of attracts you towards roles that continue doing that sort of thing, because you've already done it, you've demonstrated your experience. And so if you did something final for your master's, when you get hired, and you're on the crew, and it's going to be like, oh, hey, well, you did faunal. What do you think of this? And then you start getting more and more faunal stuff because people keep asking you. And then eventually that becomes like, you become like actually hired because you're a faunal person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that doing a master's on a tangential topic, you know, something that's not directly what you're doing. So like, you know, maybe I'm not going to do how to do a pipeline or, you know, I mean, and that's kind of a caricature, sorry. Or, you know, like specifically like for this particular region or something like that, that doesn't mean that I'm not getting skills from within my master's project that are applicable and perhaps even beneficial towards the job at hand. And to give you an example, for my master's thesis, 20 years ago, I was doing piece plot data within an academically excavated site. And for the past 20 years, I had done nothing related to that. except for the fact that it, you know, I did it within GIS, so I had some GIS skills, and mm-hmm. yeah, that continued on. That, you know, oh, you know how to use GIS, and then people start handing you GIS projects. But this year, somebody asked me a question, and it's like, that's really interesting because I had to deal with that for my master's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's part of the thing that you don't know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're going to want to get, because I guarantee you that, you know, what I want out of a job now is not what I wanted out of a job 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I've changed as a person. You know, I'd like to think I have grown as a person, and you know, the real world lifestyles that I want. You know, I'm married now. I wasn't married when I got my master's. I mm-hmm. didn't even know, like, the first time I married existed when I got my master's. That, you know, people start families. People right. want perhaps a different life. And to be like, well, you know, you're wasting your time because you got a degree in archaeology and now you're doing urban planning or working at Gap, which might be a different set of, like, labor issues. I don't know that. That's really a valuable argument,
mm-hmm.
like a reasonable okay. argument.
Yeah, you know, the experiences that you can pick up in field school or in grad school along the way, you know, like there's a question of the relevance and the practicality of experiences and stuff. And so, you know, like Stephen, you were saying you were studying problems 20 years ago that, you know, still come up from time to time. And, you know, like me personally, I've worked in Belize for, you know, 10 years, and I worked in Portugal, and the work I've done there, you know, there were times when I thought, you know, like, well, I should stop working in Belize because I don't want to be a Mayanist. And, you know, then later on in my career, I've found that a lot of the theoretical approaches that were applied down in Belize have been incredibly useful back in the States, like especially settlement archaeology and all that. And also it's more about the tools that you pick up along the way, you know, and you can apply those elsewhere. And so, you know, how much of that is, you know, like, if you can't apply something somewhere else, and if you're worried about specializing too much in something, how much of that is just like your personal limitations rather than the limitations of the skills and perspectives you're dealing with?
I wholeheartedly agree. The skills that you learn, not only in the process of getting a job in cultural resources, but the jobs that you have in cultural resources, those contribute to success in many other fields.
Yeah, you know, I would never say that getting a master's degree in something that you're passionate about, but that may not have anything to do with, let's just say, CRM in, I don't know, historic urban context on the East Coast, which is where you happen to be working. But you get a master's degree studying the Maya, like, you know, like Chris was saying. I'm not saying don't do that. Okay. And I'm not also saying that it wouldn't be beneficial to you in certain ways, like Stephen mentioned his example, you know, later on in your career, because you don't know what you're going to be doing. All I'm saying is, if you do have an idea of what you want to do, if you do actually have that focus, then pick a degree that helps you with that. I find that a number of people, just like in your undergrad, when you finally have to land on, you know, making a choice so you can graduate, that a lot of people will go into something that they're, you know, they're maybe mildly interested in, maybe they're very interested in early on, and then find out later on that they're not exactly interested in that. Maybe they drop out of the program, maybe they finish the program and they never do that again, you know, something like that. Not always the case, but that's not to say they didn't learn valuable skills and abilities, you know, that they can use. So, you know, it's all about education. I mean, the worst case scenario is you went to school for a couple of years and learned something. That's not a bad scenario, you know, that's not a bad situation.
Yeah, and just to expand on that really quickly, you know, like Steven has mentioned before, a degree doesn't equal a job, but also I would expand on that and say that a master's in archaeology doesn't equal job security.
For sure.
You know, like things change and, you know, like projects end. And like Steven had brought up, you know, life changes. Sometimes you get married. Sometimes you move around. Sometimes you have kids, you know, so there's a lot of flexibility and, you know, what you might have studied might not be relevant to you anymore. You know, it's very well relevant to the field of archaeology, but it might not be relevant to you anymore. So that's the kind of thing that you got to think about, you know, and the kind of motivations and end goals that you have for it. Are you just trying to pick up an RPA so that you can get a promotion at a firm? Because that's kind of what my motivation was going into grad school, you know, to be quite honest. And then once I was in grad school, I realized that I had a whole ton of opportunities and different avenues I could go with. And so, you know, RPA stopped being my end goal. You know, but everything changes. And, you know, a lot of times I've ended up walking away from archaeology for extended periods of time, because it's not paying the bills or it's not accomplishing what I want. And I think that, you know, that's something to remember, is that you don't always have to stick with it in the capacity that you thought you would.
For sure. Life changes. There's lots of things you can do. I wouldn't have thought I'd be where I am now, you know, 10 years ago. I'm doing like six different things, but I'm still, they're all related to archaeology, you know, and Chris, you're helping out with a number of them. So, you know, who'd have thought we'd be here? And that's not to say you got a CRM master's degree, you're going to stay in CRM for the rest of your life. You know, I was never saying that, but you know, it's all about focus. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, so here's a question for you guys. So, I mean, we've been throwing around this term, you know, the drive-through degree, and that's basically because it's a derogatory term used by other archaeologists to put down the UK degree in the US, mainly for a lot of people who do the sort of Leicester, which is actually online master's. But do you guys, so we've been talking sort of high level, you know, what we think a degree does or does not do, or what it should or should not do. But in practicality for like listeners, do you think where you got a degree and what your topic is makes a difference in your career and getting a job?
I do think it matters a little bit, but that just matters the program that you went through. You know, if you're going to list it that you got it, that you went through this program, I want to know what you studied. I don't want to know where. I want to know where, but I also want to know what you studied. You know, I'm interested in that. What did you learn while you're in that program?
Yeah, projects are really the new resume. So, you know, if you, well, take it from me, I went to Boise State, where I didn't even actually get told CRM existed. And then I went to the University of Idaho, where at least I knew about CRM and got to do some stuff, but it's a tiny school in the middle of nowhere, right? So it's really what you do, the projects, that's what matters. You can get your degree from Leicester, but if you did a project that's applicable to cultural resources, I mean, that's really what counts when you're looking at a resume, in addition to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly. yeah, so two points on that. Yes, it does affect your hiring. One, because like Bill was saying, it comes down to projects, and where you go to grad school can affect the types of opportunities that you get as far as building your experience goes. So that's a really big factor. Two, it kind of depends on where you're coming from a job experience and undergrad education, and finding a program that is compatible or augments what you've already done. And those are important considerations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chris, did you have a comment on this as we close out the show?
Nah.
Nice. Well, that's a good point to end on. I think that sums it up. No, we are going to end the show here, but this is this has been a really great discussion. I think, I mean, the takeaway here is there isn't an answer. There isn't one answer that we can give everybody. If you come to any one of us and say, should I get a master's degree and should I get it here, you're going to get an hour long podcast about it. Okay, because it's a complicated question. It's not. There is really no right or wrong answer. You have to figure out what's right for your life. You have to figure out what's right for your educational needs and for your career needs. And there are a lot of choices. And I think that's one of our next podcasts is talking about the fact that there are a lot of choices. There are a lot of ways you can do this. To say you're an archaeologist doesn't mean like, you know, I feel like if you saw archaeologist in the dictionary, it's going to say one thing. It's going to have a one-line response, but that's not true. You can do 100 different things, a million different career paths, lots of different ways to say, I am an archaeologist. It doesn't necessarily have to be digging in the dirt every day and doing those sorts of things. So on that note, I think we'll end this show and come back next time with possibly a discussion that leads in that direction. Thanks, everyone, for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye.
Really?
Really.
Bye.
Jesus. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle. And edited by Chris Sims.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
If you like this podcast, you may be interested in other podcasts that focus on the humanities. In fact, if you search Twitter for the hashtag Humanities Podcast, you'll find plenty of shows on history, language, literature, philosophy, art, and more. These podcasts are by people who enjoy telling stories, exploring the arts in our world, and who want to share that knowledge. Some examples of podcasts you'll find are The Endless Knot, an in-depth podcast featuring history, etymology, and all-around fun facts about a different topic every episode. The Story Behind, a short narrative podcast featuring the extraordinary history of ordinary objects, people, or places, or the Archaeology Podcast Network, which features a variety of podcasts focusing on archaeology. Search hashtag Humanities Podcast today or follow Humanities Podcasters on Twitter. And if you're a Humanities Podcaster, use the hashtag in your tweets so others can find you.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.